Voice was shot, brother. I could still type this voice across one question he had. And I couldn't answer it. And we were going to pass it on to you. But we never got around to doing it. Anyway, it has to do with the solar panels on the Orion spacecraft. If you look at them, like if you know, you have a picture up on your website, you know, scroll down a couple of pages, you know, see that picture of the spacecraft solar panels. And he's wondering what all those squiggly lines are. You know, naturally we're guessing, you know, with one another, thinking, well, maybe it's thermal purposes for expansion or contraction. You know, they're always moving them around for different firings. They, you know, maybe it has to do with thermal. Or we don't know. It looks like, you know, haphazard lines are on those solar panels. We're trying to figure out what they are for. Anyway, back to you, Roy. If anybody comes up with an answer, we'd like to know. I searched the internet. I couldn't find it.
Oh, okay. Well, let's open it up for general discussion. I see it. Let's see. It's from November 13th. So if you go to roy.at2gs.com, the link page, and you go down to where it is, it says, above it, it says from November 13th, 2022, you see the squiggled line. I would tend to think it's just an artifact of the wiring harness that they decided to use for it. I don't think there's an esoteric reason because it does not strike me as terribly regular. So I'm thinking it's just a wee bit haphazard on their part.
Yeah, okay. You know, we've got, you know, they have cameras on the ends of the solar panels. There's four solar panels at the very ends. There's actual GoPro cameras, you know, off-the-shelf cameras that they're using. And so it's not wired in directly. They're using Wi-Fi. And then Chris brought up a question about power. But, you know, it was only a 26-day flight, and today, you could put a camera, you could put batteries in there in a couple of months, no problem. You know, I dropped out of there. Dropped out for a second. Okay, anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay, I blew it up so I could get a better appreciation, and it really kind of degrades the aesthetics. If you blow up that image that's on that you sent me, there's one segment that's rather nicely, almost sign-like, and then the whole wiring harness starts to look ragged beyond that point. So again, if anyone else has a better idea, I'm more than happy to hear it, but it strikes me that it's probably just a wiring harness of the solar panel.
Yeah, the only thing I know for sure is a lot of the hinges, you know, outside of that. It's against a couple of the straight lines, I'm thinking that they're, you know, wiring going from one panel to the other. You know, those panels are all folded up, so when they open up, it has to be some kind of flexible wiring to do that. Why it's across the panel like that, you know, that's still unknown. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay, you know, it may simply be that they have kind of a secondary a wiring in case the primary fails. The first segment has an upper and a lower length of wire, one that seems relatively straight, the other one is wavy. Then you go to the next panel and you lose sight of the lower wire harness, if that's what it is, and the upper wire harness looks like it's doubled up, as though, you know, someone just moved both of the struts up there and they're kind of crisscrossing each other. And then the third panel is even a bigger mess in that it's going more diagonal. I think one wire is actually going vertical and the other is diagonal. So, curious.
anyway, it worked good. I mean, the whole thing put out 16 kW. They were hoping for around 13. They got more than that. They got like 16. But so they worked good. And let's think, well, maybe there's only panels on one side of it. But the side that's a little squiggly that you see is on the side that normally faces the sun. See, they take the back end of the spacecraft and they always point that part to the sun to keep the heat lower inside the cabin, inside the capsule itself. So, you know, I'm going to continue to look into it. Maybe someday I'll find it. I'll report back to you.
Okay, very good. You could sort of see the direction that the sun is coming from because of the shadows produced. And it's kind of nice that there's a picture of our little blue marble in the background. You know, it's a nice composition.
That confirms the direction that the spacecraft always sits. If you look at the shadow of the Earth, it's exactly in line with the shadow, any shadow that's being produced on the spacecraft. Any other time they change that, you know, I mean, they'll orient it all the time as they fly over, keeping it toward the sun. But any time they change it drastically, as if they're going to do a burn, say, you know, when they're going around the moon or something, they'll put the attitude control thrusters on, they'll change it. And then fly the engine, and when they get a chance, it will turn back against the rear end, the engine end, always facing the sun. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. Thank you. And it, for people who don't watch too much YouTube, congratulations to you. If you were to kind of listen to a YouTube channel from some of these insane flat earthers, they would take a look at this picture and tell you it was fake. And if you ask them why the heck it's fake, they would tell you, we are the stars. I don't see any stars.
That's true. That's true. Very good. Oh, my God. This is studio.
Yeah, these guys think that Photoshop was designed in 1962.
I like the one where the astronaut is about 3 feet in the air and he's getting his picture taken with the flag in the background. But, you know, well, actually, they actually planned it. He jumped up in the air and they wanted to time it just right. And then the conspiracy theorists are saying, look at that. His feet aren't touching the ground. I laughed when I heard that one.
Yeah, a brain is such a terrible thing to waste.
Yes, it is. Okay, I think you said you had another question, right?
Yes, indeed. We have one more person on my list tonight, and I hope that Jim has stayed around for us. What's your question, topic, or comment for tonight, Jim?
Thank you. I have two, but obviously there's not enough time for two, so I'm going to throw out the two topics, and you can pick the one that you think most fits our time frame. I'd like to revisit the electric car conversation. A couple things came to mind over the last couple weeks that I'd like to share. Or we can talk about internet link repeaters and some ramifications of that. Roy, your pick.
Okay, I've had EV electric vehicles on my mind this past week, so let's dip into that one.
So I saw a video recently, which I'll tell you about at the end of the thought, and that reminded me of this. Back in the mid-80s, I was involved for a short time in the construction trade, and I bought myself a Makita 9.6-volt drill that had a stick battery that is changed. While you're working with one, you would charge it. And it changed the tool industry completely. Until that time, electric tools were anecdotes. They were clever little things that you played with, but they didn't have a useful industrial for practical purposes because they were, because you had to charge the tool for overnight to use it for a short amount of time. And that Makita drill changed the world because it created a practical way to be charging a battery while you were working, and it got the charge time down to where there was a reasonable turnaround time where you, unless you were doing something intense, you could have a battery in a charger, battery in a drill, and work 100% duty cycle. Well, it probably takes 3 batteries to do 100% duty cycle. A practical duty cycle was due. And it changed the world as far as tools. I'm going to drop for a full cycle, and I'll continue. So with that in mind, I saw a video the other day of a taxi in the 40s, a taxi company running a system where they were running electric taxis, and they were changing the batteries. Literally, they unbolted the whole front end of the car, it was an electric car. They used a multi-100-pound lead-acid batteries, and they put a forklift, took out the old one, put in a new one, bolted the front, throw it back on the car, 10 minutes. Now, I think what we're dealing with today with these electric cars that are being forced upon us is clever things like they had before the mid-80s with tools where they could be made to, shown to work without any realistic duty cycle. Changing the batteries is the key to making the whole thing work. It's totally doable. So, anyway, I wanted to kind of throw out the concept of the electric tool, which has become wildly successful these days. With the exchangeable battery. I asked my son, had bought dozens of electric tools, all use the same battery. It's amazing. So it's out there, the bright minds here. Thoughts. Back to Roy.
I have some thoughts on that.
Okay, Ed, let me put my 2 cents in, and then I'll let you put in your 2 cents. I think what fundamentally changed the idea of battery-driven tools is the modern energy density of modern batteries. Lithium-ion especially is able to supply a great deal of current over a short period of time. Also, the recharge time for these batteries are much better than the older technology. So I think it's primarily the battery technology, which has always lagged almost every other technology. Solid-state engineering and such has gone incredibly beyond the rate of battery development. And people have mentioned this before, that you swap in and swap out batteries. The way that present electric vehicles are designed is the batteries are integrated into the structure of the chassis, so being able to top it out would require re-engineering it. Also, it would increase the need for batteries. You would need to have a secondary set of batteries for everyone, and we're already kind of getting tight on lithium in many places. And it's a big, heavy operation. It's not something that you could. It's not as easy to do as filling a gas tank. So it would require some industrial heavy duty lifting, re-engineering, oversupply of a limited resource like lithium batteries. So I don't really think it's viable in the future as electronic vehicles go. But I'm open to discussing it. Ed, I'm sure you have an opinion.
I've had many long discussions with friends and relatives and potentials, not that different from yours, Roy. Come on. Item number one. On Long Island, virtually all electric power available for recharging recharge batteries derives from fossil fuels. And shutting down, to your point, a couple of years ago, drove the state through that vampire part of non fossil fuel energy. Renewables still are, you know, like solar energy is still a tiny percentage of the total. So the main place where the electric car is really coming handy is just to utilize renewable energy. And around here, every Tesla we see on the road on the island is basically derived from fossil fuels. Second item, a home charger is usually based on 230 volts and 30 amps, which it turns out to be something like 7 kilowatts. You have to charge that thing overnight. And to do any kind of a, which is fine, you know, you take your car, you drive a little bit during the day, you don't go anywhere near the maximum range, and you can charge at night. But what people don't realize is you do a fast recharge. Not only the problems with the battery technology, you're dealing with tremendous power levels. You're dealing with tens of kilowatts. That is a tremendous amount of power that if something goes wrong, this whole thing will blow up like a bomb. And you also have to run it off, you know, high voltage distribution lines. You just don't get enough power out of the residential network to do a fast charge. Roy?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, those are not exactly addressing what Jim was bringing up of different ways of dealing with electric cars. But the you know, the ecological impact is problematic in areas where, as you mentioned, you're just kind of pushing it up the chain of command, if you were. You're still using the same fossil fuels. Instead of burning them out of the end of your car, you're burning them in an electrical generator, which is supplying power for the cars. And if you think the high amount of power required for reasonably rapid charging a car, can you imagine the problem of engineering some kind of power station that charges Tesla's new truck? I think those are going to be a disaster personally, but he is supposedly building them.
Oh, one other thing. I have heard proposals of where the cars would be designed for free change of the batteries and like be pulled into a station and you do a battery swap and drive off. The problem is, now they do that in some stores, they do that with, you know, 20 pounds of barbecue propane tanks. But the odds are of getting stuck with a turkey in a tank is very real, but it's, you know, low impact. Whereas these car batteries probably is worth over $10,000. And getting stuck with a turkey of a battery could be a huge legal type problem with everybody just doing everybody else. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I mean, some of these battery packs are incredibly expensive, and just the inventory. I mean, how do you, you know, what do you do if you're for a gas station, and you have to have, I guess by law, a certain number of freshly charged $10,000 batteries? You know, that's a lot of investment. I mean, that pales the cost of building those fireproof gasoline substitutes that the gas station has to build. I don't know. I don't personally see it. There's a big difference in my mind between a build, you know, natural gas or some other propane or such versus, you know, God knows, I don't know, what it is, 1,000 pounds of lithium batteries? And also, they're somewhat a little bit more dangerous than gasoline, usually. You know, I mean, both of them could be dangerous, but still, I don't know. It doesn't strike me as a good possible way of doing things. I see too many things going terribly, terribly wrong.
Interesting observations, interesting comments. I'll remind you that most people's enthusiasm for the whole electric car thing comes from the fact that they'll say my drill works and my sander works and my net works, but it's the nature of the fact that there's the interchangeable batteries that makes the whole thing function in a practical sense, other than in an anecdotal way. And you brought the point that the electric car, the batteries in an electric car are roughly 1,000 pounds, whether it's full or empty. And work is defined as a force through a distance. And if you're dragging 100 pounds of empty battery around the country, there's an awful lot of wasted energy happening. So there's a lot of unanswered questions in this topic, and I think this is to kind of knock them around. I enjoy the fact that we can do this.
That recognized, let me just throw out my little two cents worth, that's one of the principal reasons that I think the electric truck at this point with battery technology, what it is very problematic because it limits the load, and just about everyone is interested in how much poundage you can carry a certain distance. It doesn't make people happy that you can carry it maybe a little bit faster, but only half the size, because that's a big impact. That's a lot. And I think what people will find, other than the fact that the trucks probably break down a lot, more than was guaranteed, is that the carrying capacity at speeds that they want to make it go at are not going to make anyone happy. And if they fast charge the batteries quickly enough, they are going to shorten their lifespan, and although Tesla car batteries cost, you know, $10,000-$20,000, I'm not, I probably would guess that the truck batteries cost more like $40,000 or $50,000. So that's not going to make people happy. So these trucks, I don't think, are going to be a success, like many things that Elon has been doing lately. Yes, Ed, now.
I've given this a tremendous amount of thought, and I think the good answer really isn't getting much attention is the plug-in hybrid. Now, admittedly, the problem with any hybrid is that you have a dual propulsion system. Now, the idea of a hybrid really should be an ideal hybrid is an electric car with a small gasoline or similar whatever fuel power generator, so that when you're on the highway running about, you know, 20 horsepower engine needs the battery charged. And so you have the battery, you make the car that when locally on. You're on the highway, you turn on the engine, and it keeps the battery from depleting, but, you know, as a rule, you're only drawing 20 horsepower to drive the car. But here's another item on that, is that with a plug-in hybrid, normally for mundane stuff, charge it overnight, you go for a drive, you never have to start the gas engine. As I understand, the plug-in hybrids have fairly small batteries. They only give you like a 20-mile range on the battery, but they assume they kick off the engine. And I think that's not really an optimal solution. Now, totally different point. Let me let it drop. They are talking about using batteries for airplanes. And here's a problem I have not heard from anyone. If you've ever done one of those nightmare long flights, you realize the plane takes off, it waddles through the air like a pea as it slowly climbs up to 29,000 feet, and it sits there for a couple of hours before it slowly goes up to, say, 39,000 feet. And what it is, they have so much fuel on board that they can't go over 29,000 feet. That's all they can do to get there until they burn some of it off. A discharged battery weighs as much as a fully charged battery, so So an airplane, there's no benefit from, you know, losing weight through the fuel burnout, which in some cases could be trivial, in some cases could be significant, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. Battery technology in some cases is fantastic. In the cases of long-haul trucks, and especially airplanes, as you mentioned, it's not good because of the reason that you gave, is that the energy in a gas tank is converted into something that can be gotten rid of without losing any money. Gasoline or kerosene, in the case of jets, burns, but you let out the water and carbon dioxide, and you can vent that to the atmosphere, and everyone's happy. Batteries just sit there, take up a lot of mass, and so they are probably not very good for devices that need to be lower weight, things that carry extra weight. The amount of weight carrying they have will be impacted by using a different technology such as batteries. So I think batteries tend to have a glamour right now this week. Hopefully this will change. And you mentioned hybrids. In the old days, if you mentioned hybrids, people would say the word Prius and get depressed. You know, Priuses were not a sexy car and still are not a sexy car. They might be able to tweak the aspects of the hybrid to make them more optimal. That doesn't seem to be the way the hype is going. Everyone and their brother is trying to come out with an electronic and not really mentioning the fact that the charging facilities burn, gas. And some of them even burn coal, which is worse. So I agree with you.
And those are your comments.
Okay, Wesley first, and then someone said comment.
Yeah, take the comments first.
Okay, the person said comment.
Charlie, 82KH. I've been sitting back listening, and what a lot of people feel to fail to realize is the massive amount of strip mining in the world to produce lithium, which you need massive vehicles to strip mine and process using fossil fuels to create them. And then what do we do when we have millions of these vehicles, those pipe stands run out, and you have, what do we do with these lithium, dangerous lithium batteries that we can't recycle? Just, I think it's insanity, and it's just designed to make money for China. But I'll stick with gas and oil. Wesley?
That's the wrong response.
Okay, I don't kind of think it's purely Chinese. I don't trust the Chinese government. I don't trust the Chinese Communist Party as far as I can throw them, and I can't throw them very far. I think, unfortunately, people have glamorized electric battery vehicles. They're not really thinking in terms that the battery itself is a high-tech, requiring scarce goods that rip up the earth and have an ecological price to be paid. Probably, as time goes on and the amount of lithium available, technologies will become more available that can effectively take apart and reassemble used lithium ion-based batteries. Again, don't think it's particularly a plot. I think it's just a general marketing ploy that a lot of people are feeding into. There are people with electric cars. They love their electric cars. There are people like you, Charlie, that think it's all a scam. To a degree, it's a marketing scam, because they do not tell people the price ecologically for the battery technology and building the batteries and putting in new batteries and the power supply that's mostly due to a high carbon footprint generators. So like anything, everything is a marketing play. Everything, unfortunately, is a grift, Charlie. I'm sure you will realize that by now.
Absolutely, but there's a lot of things people don't consider. And again, you can't produce electric to run all these things and charge them. I'll let Wesley pick it up. Thank you.
And thank you very much for that. Mr. Roy, I have a question for you. Because we were talking about tritium, I was up before for quite a time, so I'm back right now. So we have a laser beam that is pointing at tritium. What do we have the X-ray from? Do you know?
I don't know specifically. I mean, I don't know the frequency of the high power pulse lasers that are used. I don't think that that laser technology allows for X-ray lasers at this point. So I'm not sure.
When I was young, I get the best grade from one subject, and then I learned that for the rest of my life. Actually, two things. One was the prefixes of the measure units, teragita, mega, kilohexa, decadecti, centimeter, micro, nano, picos, and dot. And the second one was in particles. The wavelength of infrared is below the visible light, but it's in nanometers. So we have a centimeter, then we have millimeters, then we have a centimeter micro, and then we have millimicronar pico femto ato. So we have nano pico femto ato, right? So nano is quite big, huge, humongous. So we're talking about infrared, then we have a visible light, then we have ultraviolet. And then after the ultraviolet, we have X-ray. So no way that you're going to have X-ray, a laser beam in the frequency of X-ray. Let me drop it.
Clarify, correct.
Go ahead.
Well, I just get a little googly. Apparently there is some part of this experiment that I'm not quite sure what the heck it is. They call it a holerum. And they say the holerum, to create fusion ignition, the National Ignition Facility's laser energy is converted into X-rays inside the holerum, which then compress a fuel capsule until it explodes, creating a high-temperature, high-pressure plasma. So whatever the heck the holerum is, it seems to convert laser visible ultraviolet light to X-ray spectrum. And unfortunately, this is a little bit of a problem I have. In physics on this Earth, there is no such thing as an X-ray spectrum and a gamma-ray spectrum. That's an astronomical term, because in astronomy, you don't know the sources of the electromagnetic waves. On the planet Earth, talk to a physicist, usually, if a electromagnetic wave emanates from a high-energy electron collision, it is an X-ray by definition, no matter what the frequency. If it is an electromagnetic wave emitted as part of a radioactive decay material, it is by definition a gamma ray.
Does have some sort of
interesting sense. Feel free, Ed.
And then I'm going to explain.
Once upon a time, I served in firm working for an industrial laser manufacturer. And all of their lasers started with an infrared laser. And they had these frequency multipliers. They were passive. They were like some kind of crystal. That the second harmonic of the red would be for a green laser, the third harmonic would be a blue laser, and I'm assuming that holerum or whatever is some variation on that.
Yeah. Frank recognized, one sec, Frank, I just want to mention, yeah, those are optical mixer doubler crystals. You see that on green laser printers, pointers. Green laser pointers are actually LEDs that emit infrared light. Then they're passed through a doubler optical crystal, and the wavelength is one half, and that's green. So that's how you get the green pointer. I don't know if the Holuron is an optical crystal. It might be. It's probably more complicated than that. I got to go back and do a little bit more research. But Frank, you wanted to add something? Frank, I see you on Echolink. I thought I heard you in my ear, but I'll give you one more try. We'll leave the repeater to be quiet for a couple of seconds so you'll have a better chance at linking up. So if you wanted to make a comment, feel free.
Okay, there may have been a glitch there, so I'm going to just come back to this. I feel like we're on a jump here. Anyway, yeah, I've always wondered about that, about the electric cars. It's just like, sort of like the whole business of cloud servers sucking up a huge amount of energy. The energy has to come from somewhere, and it's not, fossil fuel is just being burned in the cars, instead it's being burned at a power plant. There is an advantage, it's just easier to, capture the pollutants from a fixed source than it is from a power plant. There are some advantages there, as I understand it. I think the issue is there's probably no energy source, including fusion, that has no externalities, which is the economic term. I think the engineers have a different term for it. And everybody's looking for energy, for free energy, energy without externalities, without waste. Even fusion, the token back, I think is what being experimented with. There is waste. As I understand it, helium, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's radioactive helium. So, and people thought in the 1950s, I think, that fission reactors were the taxi out, and because they needed so little fuel, they weren't going to produce any waste. Well, huge problem. So, I suspect the fusion is going to have externalities also. Go ahead.
Yeah, Frank, helium-3 is a stable isotope, so it's not that bad. Again, I got my spider senses say that people are going to argue the subject of the thermal pollution, that it's just going to act as all the energy that's extracted in matter is going to dissipate as thermal energy, heat. And so, whether the Earth is going to be capable of eliminating that extra heat from, hundreds of fusion generators scattered over the Earth. But people always come up with a reason why the sky is falling.
Yeah, I was really in there. I mean, that sounds plausible. Helium, as I understand it, really coming up, so correct me again if I'm wrong. Helium is a very light molecule. So I would think that is in fact going to dissipate and just eventually rise above the atmosphere and dissipate into space. You take it, Roy, and then give it to Wesley if we have time before the space report. Go ahead.
Okay, well, we're by AC2GS here. We're going to have to finish this up soon, otherwise we're not giving Paul much time to do anything. When The Earth doesn't have a lot of helium-3. The reason why Earth doesn't have a lot of helium-3 is because helium-3 isn't produced by the decay product in the mines where we mine helium from. Helium-3 is produced, though, on the surface of the sun, and it is part of the solar radiation. But because we have a magnetic field, that magnetic field shields us from objects like helium-3, which is why people think that you could make a profit going to the moon and mining helium-3, which is deposited in very low density over the surface because the moon does not have a built-in magnetic field shielding itself. But yeah, the helium-3 is innocuous. It'll just kind of flow up to the atmosphere and just wander away. We're party balloon helium gas has been doing since we started to have helium balloon objects.
Yeah, fusion power is eventually commercialized, may or may not happen in our lifetime. I just think there's going to be a lot more of it. For lack of a better term, metabolized out of the atmosphere. And I don't know enough about it to say what the implications of that are, and maybe nobody knows just yet. And I think the point on the lithium from the batteries is interesting. I spoke with somebody a couple of months ago who had done business in Poland and was familiar with the economic elites in Europe, who told me he thought one of the drivers behind the war in Ukraine is that Russia wanted to control the lithium in mine, the source of lithium for all these batteries that are located in the eastern Donbass. Russia is an extractive economy. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of reasons. Ukraine is the breadbasket for East Europe, so that's a good thing to have. There's a lot of value in the Ukraine that, unfortunately, Putin wanted to steal. Anyway, I think we should kind of call this to an end. Otherwise, it'll be like last week when we didn't have a space lab report. Wesley, if you want to make any closing comments before we close this segment, please.
Yeah, there is some kind of confusion. When people hear the word nuclear or radiation, they get scared. Tritium is innocent, per se. Again, cesium is 512 kilo-electron volts, 30-something years half-life. Tritium is 12.32 years half-life, and it decays with beta radiation for 5.7 kilo-electron volts. Compare it. And it releases a gamma ray in 18.6 kilo-electron volts. It's just nuts. And then we have an inverse square roll. So we are 10 centimeters from the specimen. We cannot see it. And we are very close. We have it in the hand. Cannot penetrate. Beta particle cannot penetrate the skin. So since the energy of both the beta and gamma radiation is so low, tritium can be safely used in the customer product. Radiation coming from the tritium maker isn't directly caused by tritium itself. That explains what the X-ray comes from. Because let's say we don't have a laser beam. The beta particles don't have enough of energy to pass through the plastic and are stopped by it. But this causes Bramstrahlung X-rays, which is then detected by Geiger counters. So until 1960, many watch manufacturers used radium paint in order to make the dials glowing dark. However, radium 226 is very dangerous because of this was banned and replaced by tritium, which has similar radioluminescence properties, but is much safer to use. And we're talking about the experiment that allows unlimited amount of energy to be used in the planet Earth by human animals. Okay, so the most common use for tritium is the production of radioluminescent makers. They're used in watches, gas, flight, emergency, exit lights. The radioluminescence are achieved by coating the tritium vial with the layer of phosphor from the inside. Let me drop. So when beta particles hit phosphor, they cause H2 fluorescence, releasing visible light. So when we heat that tritium with deuterium mixed together in the capsule with the laser beam, we are actually creating a branchial. But the most important is there is no waste. Zero, zip, or nothing. It's conversion to the energy. And it is 1.5 times more than the energy used to produce it. So imagine that you have a $200. Now, you get one femtosecond experiment, and you have 1.5 of that. Isn't it amazing? This is one of the biggest discoveries in the planet Earth. Enter here.
Again, the primary discovery is 60, 70, 80 years old. This is just one little technological speed bump that has to be taken on. The bottom line is, if I took all of good old Elon's money away from him, gave it to you, and said, I need a functional commercial fusion power generator, how long is it going to take you to build one? You'll look at your watch, and according to the specialist, say 25 plus years. So we're not really talking about next year. We're not talking about 5 years. We're not talking about 10 years. We're talking about 25 years. So there's a lot of wiggle room in 25 years. I agree with you. It's important. It's useful. That's why we talked about it. If I didn't think it was useful, I wouldn't talk about it. It's not going to change tomorrow, unfortunately. Maybe it'll change 2050, 2060, 2070. You know, I don't know if any of us will be around then. I hope so, but I don't think so.
It's not a prediction. The estimated time for this technology to hit the market could be a few years. It is said that it may take a decade. Now, 1962, if I remember correctly, first microwave. It was huge, humongous, like a van. It cost $50,000 at that time. Now, you can buy it for pennies, made in China. Back to you.
PhD with a technical correction.
Okay, I just want to point out that microwaves are not fusion generators. You cannot use an example of one technology to plan another one. Fusion technology, as I've mentioned a dozen times, was 20 years in the future in 1960, it was 20 years in the future in 1980, it was 20 years in the future in 2000, and now it's 20 years in the future in 2022. Jim, you want to say something?
Yeah, thank you. Wesley, respectfully, you have a degree. My degree comes from the Wizard of Oz. But this isn't working. You're pushing things to places where you're losing everybody. You understand what I'm saying?
I would appreciate, with all due respect, if you had your words explaining of how am I losing everybody. There is a difficulty in language. There is a difficulty in accent. There is a difficulty in the wording of a clear pronunciation of this word. Would you please point at which point I am confusing everybody. I do thank you very much for that.
To respectful conversation. I'm looking to make a point. Earlier you mentioned the audience. Broadcasters have audiences. Nets have participants. And our places in that, those different forums are important. I think that's probably what I'm speaking to the most. Your thoughts on photons are far, far beyond mine. I think your place in this forum needs to work on a little bit. I have no doubts about your technical knowledge as far as these mine, but you've got to adapt to the forum that you're in, and I think we can all adapt to your language. No sweat. No problem at all. Sorry to throw a monkey wrench into the conversation, but I felt it had to be said. Wesley, much respect. Take it under consideration.
I do thank you very much for that explanation. I would ask Dr. Roy to translate it from English into English that I can understand. If you are touched with the words that I use, I was using quotes. Sometimes it helps when I'm looking at some comments. So the comment that I started was written by the Greenpeace activist. That's why she used the wording human animal and cruelty and whatsoever. So, and I pointed specifically at the quote. So then when I'm talking about that quote, I'm using the language used in the quote. It's not my words. If it hurts you, if you disagree that you are Mamal, that's fine with me. You are not Mamal, you never heard about Darwin. That's fine with me. Do we understand each other? And understand. I'm sorry. And to agree.
I was speaking mostly about the way that we interact with one another, give each other returns, let each other throw out a thought. Some people are more coherent, some people are fancier, some people are more technical. Like I said, my degree comes from the Wizard of Oz. Definitely have eons of more technical expertise than me. Ed is amazing with what he brings to the table. Somewhere in the middle, we all meet and enjoy each other's company. And I enjoy yours and whatnot, but I could raise my bar a little bit, and maybe you could lower yours a little bit, and we could have a little more fun. I don't know. Back to Roy for commentary.
One more thing. I'm raising the voice only whenever I'm looking for the proper words. With so many languages that I operate with, it's hard for me. It's not easy. I understand 27 Slavic languages. And at least, apart from that, I speak fluently three of them. And the fourth one is English. I do apologize for that. I'm not trying to create a problem. Now, the reason that I was a little bit pushing for the voice on the repeater was that I was in the middle of few many things in the house, two telephone calls whatsoever. I apologize for that. Usually, I try to patiently wait for the time that the microphone is given to me. Dr. Roy.
Guys, this could go on forever and ever and ever. And if nothing else was going on simultaneously, fine. But we're really, Paul, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, Paul. We've got to call an end to this. We can take it up next week if everyone wants to. I leave it up to them. Well, actually, I don't leave it up to them. Next week is the 25th. It's Christmas Day, and we're all taking the day off. So I'll be back, by the way, January 1st, and we can take it up January 1st. But we got to cut this short because it's getting ridiculous. It's 10:56. So please, everyone, be kind to each other. Be nice. It's supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to raise your blood pressure. So with that in mind, I thank everyone who participated tonight. Once again, I apologize profusely to you, Paul. Please give us the SpaceNet report.
No problem. AQ2GS, WS2N. And I'm a half hour ago thinking about Jim's conversation about the Makita drill. Best drill ever put on the market. I've used them as well. Unbelievable. They have a chuck on it. If you drill something in, it would just stop right at the, you know, whatever, you know, you can set it with the strength that you wanted. Oh, and unbelievable. And, you know, at first they came out on, the Makitas were plug-ins, but then they went to battery. Incredible. Anyway, the Space Nap report, let me just do a quick year in review anyway. We'll get that in. Because we're at the end of the year. This year we finish up with launching the Space Launch System. It's a multi-billion dollar, over $4 billion project. Finally got underway after many years of delay. The first launch was supposed to be 2017. Well, everything turns out, the report's coming backwards. 1 month as such, the new engines, well, refurbished engines, they're like new. The RS-25 that used to be on the shovels, they took them, put them on the bottom of SCS, and wound up with, they put out a 109% thrust instead of a lower number, because these are going to be throwaways now. They're just going to go into the drink. They're not going to bring them back and refurbish them like they did with the shuttle. So they run them at higher thrust. The launch went perfect. The separation of all the different stages, the 3.5 million pound thrust, solid boosters separated, the core stage separated, the in-term cryogenic propulsion stage, that's the next stage up, all worked perfectly. The 10 CubeSats that were inside of that stage after separating from the Orion spacecraft, they went off into space. Some of them are actually heading to the moon. Some are going into solar orbit. The Orion spacecraft itself, we talked about that before, with four solar panels. That had a 6,000-pound engine on the back of it, called the OMS engine, the Orbital Maneuvering System, from the space shuttle. The space shuttle had them for re-entry. They used one of those for the Orion spacecraft itself, to go around the moon. That was attached to the service module. And then it did a distant retrograde orbit, about 1,000 miles actually away from the moon. Stayed there for half a dozen days, and then used that same 6,000-pound engine to deorbit and eventually come around the moon and to another orbit, and then headed back toward Earth, successfully testing its 16-foot diameter heat shield. That was one of the main tests that they wanted to do. Got up to around 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Successfully came through the atmosphere. That slowed it down from 25,000 miles per hour down to around 400, a little below 400 miles an hour. When a set of 11 chutes had to come out, parachutes, different chutes came out for different reasons. Eventually, the last three are the main chutes. Each one was 106 feet diameter. Slowed the whole spacecraft down to about 16 miles per hour before it actually hit the splashdown in the Pacific Coast. A ship called Portland, a Navy ship, scooped it up. This type of ship has, they actually flood the lower bay, and they bring it back, back it into the spacecraft. The spacecraft floats or into the boat. They actually pull it in with cables, but after it's in, they close it off, and then they pump that water out, and then that dries everything up. Worked very, very well. Now it's back on dry land. It landed around 500 miles south of San Diego. Due to bad weather, they were going to land a couple hundred miles away, but it went further south.